Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to That's a Take. Here we are with another journey into the mystical realms of filmmaking knowledge via someone who is doing it, someone who lives it. Our guest today is Benjamin Schmidt, the writer, director, DP, and editor of Ellie and Xavier, a no-budget feature film. And that is our subject for this episode, producing a no-budget feature film. This topic is near to my heart because for whatever reason, I really root for those people who just go for it. Ben and I have worked on several projects before. He's really come through for me in a lot of scenarios. And when I found out he was taking on this task, I was really impressed. And I wanted to try to support him any way I could. A feature film is a monumental task, and Ben persevered through a lot to get Ellie Xavier made. He could have given up several times, but he did not. He saw the project from the start to the very end. Watching his film on a big screen with him in the room truly made me proud, and it also really inspired me. It felt like pure cinema. It reminded me of a Cassavetes film. Rough and raw, but human. Very human. In this episode, we discuss the hurdles Ben faced to complete this project, why he wanted to undertake this task, and how the process helped to inform his own filmmaking practices. With that, let's get right into Take 8 with Ben Schmidt. Yeah, I like your Jurassic Park.
Thank you.
Visor.
Yes.
Where'd you get it?
Universal, actually.
Really?
I was there with my family about 2 years ago now.
Oh,
and,
nice.
I've lamented that finding visors for guys is kind of hard because the market for visors is like me and like 50-year-old like wine moms who play golf. And so I found a Captain America visor that said Super Mom in Universal. And so I bought it because I thought it was funny. And literally we were waiting for our shuttle to take us back to the airport. And I passed a gift shop that had this in it. And I just like ran in and bought it real quick. And my mom came out like, Ben, where the hell are you? Our shuttle's here. And I'm like, just wait, I'm buying this.
So Universal's in Florida, right?
Florida,
in Orlando.
Yeah.
I was just in Orlando and I was just like shocked at how many people were there.
Yeah, no, it's a really kind of strange city in a lot of ways because it's like...
Yes.
Like if you took the tourism out, it would be absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I agree.
Like I think it even has like a pretty small population for how bustling the city is, but it's just all tourism.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting place, that's for sure. I'd like to go again sometime, but I just was there and I was like, I'm good in this place. The airport was a little stressful, not gonna lie.
And you know, the theme parks are fun, but they're exhausting.
Yeah.
Like I remember one, my mom loves Disney World, and so we would go to Disney World a lot as kids.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one like week-long vacation we took there and we stayed on Disney. And by the end of it, I was just so exhausted.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we had, like, the last day where we didn't have anything planned. It's like, oh, do you want to go to any of the parks or anything? And even though I'm, like, 13, I'm like, no. I just want to stay in and nap.
Yeah, I went when I was a kid with my cousins and my mom and my aunt, and it was really fun. But I don't really need to go again.
Yeah.
The older I get, the less I like stuff like that. I don't know.
I still like, you know, I like my thrill rides. I like roller coasters and stuff like that. But, again, it's like... If I can just go to a place and get it all done in like one day, it's like
that's better.
Yeah, that's satisfying. I don't need to make a whole big deal out of it.
Yeah. So did you guys party hard after the premiere yesterday?
Oh yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I had to take a break at one point, drink some water.
Yeah.
Call it a little early, but I'm feeling pretty good today.
So it reflected some scenes in the film.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that was fun. For context for those listening, yesterday, March 29th, 2025, Ben had booked the Varsity Theater in Des Moines, Iowa to do a private screening that turned into just kind of a screening of Ellie and Xavier, his feature film that was just completed.
Mm-hmm.
So we might reference the premiere. By the time you hear this, that will be in the past, but it was just yesterday.
It's fresh.
Today. So yeah, you just completed this feature film, Ellie and Xavier, that was completely written, directed, edited, and co-produced by yourself.
Yes.
Where did this idea for this script come from, and how did you start like from square one with a very simple, doable idea? Like you said yesterday at the screening that you knew a couple things about the script, and one was that you wanted to write a script about two people.
Yeah. So kind of funny enough, the like initial like genesis of this script actually started when I was in high school. So when I was like 15 or 16, I was really starting to get into independent film, was realizing that like, oh, there are people that just go out and shoot a movie and they get people to see it, and you don't need a studio or name actors or anything. And that, you know, filmmaking, especially, I grew up in a very small town, less than 2,000 people. Like filmmaking to me always felt like it had to be big budget Hollywood, that sort of thing. So when I kind of discovered like, oh, there's another way to make movies, basically, that was really exciting, and that felt very attainable. So I was, probably about 15 or 16 when I started thinking about the idea that would evolve into this. And it really did come down to, okay, what do I have access to? Who can I cast in this movie? I have friends that I can cast. I know I was in theater, so I knew actors. And so an idea that just seemed possible was this idea about two people who meet at a party and end up spending the night together. Because, you know, I know I have friends who could be in it. I had, you know, houses we could shoot in. We could shoot a party scene. All things that sounded easy in concept when you're just starting out. But so that seemed like a very doable idea from the beginning. But it was never a script that I finished at the time. But it was always an idea in the back of my head. Like, oh, yeah, that might be something I could do at one point. And then when I got to college, I, for like the idea kind of came back to me because it sort of felt better for a college setting. And I sort of was feeling like my experience at college was very different from what I was seeing portrayed in media, because college is typically always portrayed as like, oh, the partying and the drinking and the sex. And I was like, I don't know, I'm kind of like having an existential crisis over here, y'all. Like, is everyone else okay? So transitioning the story to college was the first thing that kind of made it more interesting to me, I suppose, and made it feel a little bit more personal. And I toyed with it a little bit. And then after I finished my short film that's also set in college called Is It Snowing Where You Are, I kind of wanted to do a film similar to it, but with a completely, it's almost like the inverse of it, where like that film was very, I don't want to say depressing, but very sort of like downbeat and, and very melancholic. And I wanted to do something a little bit more hopeful and something a little bit warmer and a little bit, have a little bit more humanity to it, I suppose. And so I kind of wanted to do the inverse of that set at college. And at that point I was about 22 years old, and I was thinking, you know, back to the last 4 years, I dropped out by that point, but all my friends were graduating and this sort of area of my life was coming to an end. So I started thinking a lot about it. And that's when I wrote the first draft of what would become Ellie and Xavier, which at the time wasn't quite the two-hander that it is. It was more of a Dazed and Confused of American Graffiti, like followed multiple characters throughout the night. But I realized pretty quickly that I was mostly concerned with Ellie and Xavier. And so about halfway through the script, it just kind of became about them. And subsequent drafts just really, really like went in on them and really, really developed their relationship, their story. And yeah, so it was a long but very sort of like, I don't know, what the word is. I almost want to say like natural like growth with it, where it started is. But I feel like that initial idea is still there, that idea of like wanting to do something small and simple and human with a, that was more than doable with the resources that I had.
It seems like you stay true to the general idea of the story too, which is sometimes difficult when you're working with no money, right? It's like, oh, I have this idea. Which I think is interesting that you chose this sort of, you know, story, because it is very simple and it was something you could do. I'm curious, and I'm kind of jumping ahead in my questions, but one of the things I was really curious about is how did you approach locations? Did you write for specific places you knew you were going to film? And like, how did you get, I'm assuming, access to a college campus, which was Clark?
It was Clark.
In Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah.
How did you do that? Because I mean, those locations typically can be somewhat difficult to get.
Yeah. And funny enough, I don't want to mention the college that the script was written for, but I was writing it for another college that we actually had permission to be at. But then when the pandemic hit, there was like a, obviously we couldn't shoot there then. And then there was a switch up in who we were talking to, and our initial contact with the location fell through. They left the college.
Yeah.
And so when we came back in 2021 to start shooting again, we couldn't shoot there anymore.
Yeah.
Whoever was in charge at that point just straight up told us no. And that was honestly, that was kind of the first big like, oh no, are we going to be able to finish this? But mm-hmm. luckily Maddie, my co-producer, knew somebody at Clark, had a contact there, and she was really, really supportive and helped us. And we really only, we shot a lot of the stuff at the college during the summer.
Yeah.
So
smart.
Yeah. So that there wasn't, we didn't have to worry too much about students or, you know, disturbing anybody. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of how that worked out.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I would say in terms of the locations, almost all except the smokestack were not originally written for the movie.
Oh, wow.
And so there was a lot of, I mean, there was, you know, there was a Chinese restaurant in the script, mm-hmm. but it wasn't, the restaurant we ended up shooting in was not the one that I initially wrote it for.
Interesting.
But that was an example of, we went to the location I'd written it for and realized this doesn't quite look right. Mm-hmm. And so we found a different location, and it was, that was just a much better decision. Yeah. It worked way better for not just the scene. It was a better, it visually looked better, mm-hmm. but it also just worked better for equipment, lighting, setting things. And then the whole story, or the big final sort of conversation happens on top of the Fenelon Place elevator in Dubuque, which mm-hmm. is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a cable car system mm-hmm. that goes up the bluffs. It's a national historic place, and it's a very big iconic thing in Dubuque. That was also not written in the script originally.
Oh, wow.
There was there was going to be something in the original college that we shot at where I knew that, like, oh, there's, like, this really nice, like, bay window on top of one of the buildings mm-hmm. that the characters can go to and have this, like, long conversation about life and, you know, what happens in the movie. And when we lost our original college, I was like, I don't know where they're going to go. Yeah. I don't know where they're going to go in the movie. And that was actually a pretty last minute decision, because living in Dubuque, or growing up around Dubuque, I always wanted to shoot a scene on the elevator just because it's,
of course,
yeah. it's iconic. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I always had this vision of, like, these two characters riding up it and the audio cutting out. And then, like, probably a month before we shot, I was like, I think that could work for this movie.
Yeah.
Like, the scene doesn't have to change much. We added a little bit of context at the beginning for why they're there. But, mm-hmm. like, that moment, which became one of my favorite moments in the movie, that was a total just, like, trying to make something work and trying to make it interesting in its own way. And I'd say, like, for that, and I think we'll probably talk a lot about, like, what you do, how to, you know, make movies with no money, and mm-hmm. when you do have things fall through. And I feel like that happens on every movie. It doesn't matter if you have money or not.
Agreed.
The big thing I would say in terms of, like, when we lost our locations was I kind of had to ask myself, like, okay, why was this location important mm-hmm. to me? And is it something that we can get from another location? So in the case of the college is just a college. Mm-hmm. We just need something that's dorms and buildings. And, like, yes, we're not shooting at the college that was significant to me, but it's still a college. It still reads as a college. It doesn't need to.
Totally.
We don't need to get super pedantic about it. And in terms of, like, the Fenelon Place elevator scene, like, that was ultimately just a scene where Ellie was taking Xavier to a place of significance to her. Mm-hmm. So as long as there is an established significance of the Fenelon Place elevator, that scene is the same.
Yes.
And honestly, it's visually much better than if we shot where we originally wanted to shoot. And I love that the shots on where we see Dubuque in the background, it's literally our poster now.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where when you are up against the wall and you lose something, I think you just kind of have to really ask yourself, okay, what is the purpose of this scene and what is the purpose of these locations? Mm-hmm. And when you really stick to that, you're going to find something that's going to work just as well, if not better.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I think, you know, for context, just a little bit of painting a picture for the listeners. Dubuque, Iowa is a sort of a river town set mm-hmm. on the Mississippi that has these big bluffs mm-hmm. that overlook what you could call downtown Dubuque, the main part of the city. And this elevator, this cable car, goes from the bottom mm-hmm. all the way up to the top of this bluff. And it's absolutely gorgeous. It's an amazing view of not only Dubuque, but of the Mississippi, where mm-hmm. it's, you know, quite wide, probably a mile wide at this point. And Dubuque is just a really picturesque city. Mm-hmm. I think it's fascinating to me that you made a film in your backyard. I love when people do that. It's something yeah. that I had the chance to do in this neighborhood, a film, Thick as Thieves, and all the locations were within 6 blocks of where we're sitting right now.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so I want to talk about that for a little bit, is like, Dubuque also, for people who haven't been there, which I'm assuming most people who are going to listen to this have not been to Dubuque, right? It is a really interesting city.
Yes.
There's a lot of like places as a filmmaker, you're like, whoa, oh my gosh, that's a location. The elevator being one of them. How much of this like was easier for you, like knowing the city? Had you thought about these places? You're like, oh, this is where this is going to take place. And I know you lost the college, but like all the other stuff, did you already know where that was going to take place?
Oh yeah. And like there's even like so many scenes that were cut in the script of like other locations that we wanted to shoot at. That just, they didn't get cut for, cause we couldn't get the location. They just got cut because they weren't important to the script.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like that was, I kind of wrote the script just kind of thinking like, oh yeah, we'll probably be able to shoot there. And honestly, like other than the college, everybody in Dubuque was super, super helpful, was super excited, was the restaurant just gave us complete run of the place because they were closed that day.
Did you pay for any locations?
We paid for one. We paid for the Smokestack because they are also a venue. So, but they gave us a considerably reduced rate. So that was actually probably the craziest night because we had 10 pages and we had to shoot in 5 hours.
Wow. Okay.
That was the only location. But again, they were very, very helpful. The people who ran the Smokestack at the time, even the elevator, we just went, we asked what day we could do it. And they said Mondays are our slowest days. So come on Monday. They were still running while we were doing it, but there was only like maybe one or two people who came up that day.
Yeah.
So
I think there's a lot of benefits to shooting a film in a place like Dubuque. I've shot a couple films there as well. And man, what you can get there is like insane.
Yeah, it's like, beautiful.
And yeah, there's so many like locations. Like we've looked at a couple locations for a period piece that like we could walk in and just start filming and not have to change anything.
Yeah.
And then there's like industrial, there's like river bluffs, there's natural areas, like there's a canyon. Like, yeah.
It's a city that like it kind of changes. Like it could be a different city every 8 blocks.
100%. There's a lot of looks.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I've worked as a delivery driver there for a number of years, and
so you've seen all of
the neighborhoods. I've seen all of the neighborhoods, and it is a true like anywhere city. It could sell for just about anything.
Yeah. Off the record, I have a film idea that I want to film in Dubuque. We'll talk about that, but I think that's maybe a good segue, because one thing that I kept feeling when I like watched the movie yesterday was there's a lot of moments that make me feel like I was watching a Cassavetes film. Like two in specific, one, which is my favorite scene in the movie. My favorite scene in the movie is the scene of her in the bathroom.
Yes.
In the mirror. Mm-hmm. I think it's the best like overall acting in the movie, even though there's no words. It's like,
it's just her.
You know exactly what she's going through, and she doesn't say a word. But also when she's riding in the car, that really feels like a Cassavetes shot. Like, and what I like about Cassavetes and what I like about Ellie and Xavier is like, there's kind of like, I don't give a fuck attitude in the film. And what I mean by that is like, you could be nitpicky about things.
Mm-hmm. And I do get to.
I'm sure it's impossible not to, but you just went and did the fucking thing.
Yeah.
And it feels so raw and authentic. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, like, with how much you were doing, how did you, like, approach the visual side of it? Like, who were your references? Who were your influences? What made Ellie Xavier feel the way it feels?
Yeah. I'd say the two, like, biggest visual influences, if I had to, like, point to movies, two movies I watched quite frequently were Et tu m'aimes tambien was one, and I guess probably more vaguely, I really love Christopher Doyle's cinematography in some of Wong Kar-wai's films. So like Chungking Express, Fallen Angels, In the Mood for Love to a certain extent. And what I really loved, especially with Et tu m'aimes tambien, Alfonso Cuarón, the director, talks about how him and Emmanuel Lubezki, you know, they they were huge directors in Mexico, and they'd gone and they'd done films in Hollywood, and this was really their kind of, they kind of got fed up with the industry and said, like, mm-hmm. fuck it, let's, I don't know if I can swear or anything, but they said, fuck it, like, let's go back to Mexico and let's make the movie we wanted to make 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, they, and, you know, you got two of the masters of the craft with their stripping everything back.
Mm-hmm.
It's handheld camera. It's three actors. It's a road trip movie. Mm-hmm. And, like, that kind of mentality, I kind of never saw the movie as having, like, any sort of, like, technical perfection, I guess. I knew going into it, because, like, when I think about those, the nights that inspired this movie, when I think about long nights walking around, drinking a little bit, maybe smoking a little bit, like, there's always, like, they're never, even if you remember the feeling, it's never quite crystal clear, you know, but you do remember the feeling. So I always wanted it to have this kind of haziness to it and this kind of, like, rough and fly on the wall style. And kind of part of that roughness also just is, because it was, the crew was often just me, a sound guy, and Maddie, my co-producer. So like, they're like, all of that, that like roughness and all of that kind of like, I don't want to say imperfection because so much of it was intentional.
Yeah.
But kind of just lean, we really just decided to lean into it as much as possible. Like, let's not make it distracting. Let's not like shake the camera to the point of it being like annoying or giving people motion sickness. But let's, you know, let's not get too worried if the camera's, you know, shaking a little bit. The whole movie is shoulder rigged. There isn't a single shot on sticks or a tripod or a dolly. And that was going in. I knew that was going to be the case. I knew there wasn't going to be. And actually there's, so there's a, I think 3 minute tracking shot just to walk and talk through the campus about a third of the way through the movie.
Yeah, that shot was awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was like, it was one of those shots where you're watching it and you're like, he's still going. Like, as a cinematographer, as the audience, you're not thinking that. Because, like, I mean, we could get into a whole philosophical discussion here, but I love shots that don't cut. I feel like for me, like, of course, like, you have to cut in a movie. Like, you don't have to. A lot of people haven't. But I love those long, continuous shots. It feels more like you're watching it. Feels more theatrical, in a good way, like where you're really honing in on what's being said. Anyways, I digress, but continue.
But
yeah, no.
But a funny thing about that shot, that was a shot that we were convinced we were, that I was like, whole movie's going to be shoulder rig except that shot, because obviously we can't do that on a shoulder rig.
It was really
rig.
Smooth.
It was. So we tried a glide cam, a type of more inexpensive steady cam, and we couldn't make it work with our rig.
Yeah.
And so I was like, all right, I have a gimbal because I use a gimbal for a lot of my client work. So I was like, okay, well, you know what? Screw it. We'll put it on the gimbal. We'll make it work. And I did one test with Maddie, and we came back and we looked at it like that, just very smooth, like, shot. And we looked at each other and we're like, this is not what Ellie and Xavier looks like. Like,
it would have stuck out. It would have stuck out if you would have done horribly. It on the gimbal.
And so I was like, and this was like right before we were about to start our biggest block of shooting. And I was like, okay, I have a week to figure something out before we shoot that shot. And just literally getting more comfortable with my rig and doing enough. Like, there were a couple of shots that were where I had to walk backwards with it. And that was, and it got to the point where I was like, I think we can do the shoulder rig for the entire tracking shot. Let's try it.
Yeah.
And I think we got that in 6 or 7 takes.
Nice. Yeah. It was really well done.
Thank
really
you.
Well executed. I, as a cinematographer, sometimes this is a weird thing, but sometimes I feel like walking backwards is easier than walking forwards.
It is.
Like, I don't know if there's any truth to that or if anyone else feels that way, but sometimes I feel like I can be smoother when I'm back pedaling.
I feel like it's almost something where, like, when you're going backwards, you kind of are forcing yourself to focus more because you have to be aware of yourself, like, spatially and everything. But
for sure.
Because, yeah, most of my backwards tracking is much better than my front.
Yeah, it's tracking. Weird how that, it's weird how that works. It sort of the approach of this film calls to mind, like, Dogma 95 as well. Was that ever a thing that you thought about, like,
I mean, definitely
intentionally?
Definitely, like as a sort of concept, yes. I mean, I wasn't necessarily referencing, like, The Celebration or The Idiots or anything.
No, but, like, not the films, but the, the sort of the rules, you know, like the you must shoot on location, like, what is it, handheld color, no filters. No murders, weapons. Let's see what else. No genre movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, they also say that the film format must be Academy 35mm, so that would be tough. And so, then also one of their rules, I think, was that the director must not be credited.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, yeah. but you had some of those similar like approaches, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I think more than anything, it was just that like we just have to go out there and do it.
Yeah.
And like, you know, a lot of it, we did light it. We didn't have a huge lighting kit, and we obviously didn't have a ton of crew to set up lights.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we had some aperture panels that we needed if we needed to fill in, mostly just, again, to fill in faces if need be.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, there was a lot of just kind of using the street lights to our advantage.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, we'll backlight them with, that. Like, there's this massive street light outside this the football field that we're shooting on.
Mm-hmm.
That's our backlight.
Yeah.
And just really like leaning into what was available on location. There's mm-hmm. the shot like when they exit the restaurant and there's all these big fake neon open signs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and it's blown out and it's crazy and we bloom the hell out of it. But I was like, we're just going to lean into it. We're just going to lean into the location and really kind of let that give the scene its character and give it its atmosphere.
Yeah. Speaking of atmosphere and character, I was sitting next to Chase Stein and we were discussing, we're like, is it 1/8 promist or 1/4 promist?
It was 1/4.
That's what we thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it really bloomed well. And I think just as a cinematographer, I think that was a really smart decision mm-hmm. because like I specifically remember the dorm scene, like in the hallway where if you didn't use that, I would have thought that was gross.
Yeah.
But the way that you bloom those fluorescents in there, mm-hmm. it looked really nice.
Yeah.
It was a great choice because it you. Like, especially for like a run and gun thing. Like that gave your film like a look to it, which was nice. And you had to do very little work to like you put a filter in your matte box, you know?
Yeah.
That was smart, I thought. And really kind of was a nice little addition.
Yeah. And it also kept shooting, like because we shot over a long period of time, it kept things consistent.
Yeah.
It helped. Like if we were to shoot from, you know, if I was to slap a modern like Sigma lens on that camera and not have a filter, it would have looked grossly out of place.
Yeah.
But yeah, we stuck with the same lenses and the same filter throughout the entire production, and that filter was on every shot.
Yeah, it helped with the skin tones too, because like some of the lighting environments were a little bit more harsh, and
yes.
It helped keep the skin tones nice, and also like then dulled down the harshness of a lot of those lights.
Yes.
I think one of the things, and sort of the theme of this whole thing today, this conversation we're having is just like do it. You like just went out and did it. Why was it important for you to like just make this instead of being stuck in years of looking for private funding mm-hmm. or a grant writing or a crowdfunding campaign? Why was it important for you to just put your own time and money and ask for favors with the homies and do mm-hmm. do the thing?
I think part of it is that I'm an incredibly anxious person who does not like to ask people for money. And I've kind of always sort of just thought this is the only way that I could make my first movie. Like, you know, I kind of referenced earlier, like I grew up in a very small town. There wasn't a lot of other people who were really interested in filmmaking. So I almost from the beginning was doing everything on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And with that came, you know, a certain amount of self-sustainability, which I like. But it really taught me that like you like know how to or it really taught me all aspects of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided I wanted to do this, I felt like the only way I could do it is if one, I knew I was not ready to ask people for money, especially it's like, what the hell have you done, kid? Like, mm-hmm. So I felt like if I make a movie with no money and I put all of, and it's financed by myself,
mm-hmm.
at the very least I can show people I have made a feature film.
Yeah.
I finished it. I got it. You know, I wrote it. I directed it. I edited it. All of that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in the future, I would like to seek financing and hopefully get a bigger crew and a bigger budget.
Yeah.
But having that, I have a lot more confidence now, just personally, knowing that I did do it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, regardless of what anyone thinks of the movie, it is my movie and it is 100% everything that I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and I accomplished it with a very, very, very minimal budget.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something to be proud of. And I think mm-hmm. you've always struck me as someone that's like a sort of a cinema film purist in a way. Like, I think you're open to like innovation and all and like genre bending and all this stuff. But I think it's really fitting that you self-produced your first feature and like did it all. I can't put it into words really, but it just like you it, as a person, it just fits you so much to do that.
I think that's the thing is like, it wasn't me. Like if I like went out and looked for funding, that just doesn't feel like something that I would do right away.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's, I was weirdly more comfortable doing it on my own and just making it work with what I had than if I like, if I had other people's money behind this, I would have been an anxious mess.
It would have
mess.
Changed it so much.
Like the entire, your entire like responsibility changes at that point.
100%.
And so like worst case scenario with this movie, if it didn't happen or never got finished, that's just on me.
Yeah.
And that it just eats away at me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But if other people's money was behind it or there was like a deadline that I had to hit, it would have been a nightmare. I would have hated making it.
Yeah. There's a lot of restraints that come with not having any money, but there's also a lot of freedom. And I think that's important to think about. I think this is a good time to talk real quick about the schedule and how you went about making this film. Cause I think that's a little unique.
Yeah.
And I know like, I don't want to focus too much on the amount of time that it took you to do this. Like, I don't know that that's that valuable or important. I think it's more about like the schedule, like, You sort of piece things together and then you talk about having quote unquote a hell week.
Yeah.
So just talk about like how you made this film as far as like when you were filming and how.
A little bit of context before we get to, I did cast the movie in 2020 and then obviously the pandemic happened. So by the time we actually, restrictions were up, people were getting vaccinated, everyone felt safe to go back and start shooting. My main actress, Sydney, who plays Ellie, had moved back to Chicago. But I was not going to recast her because we had already done so much preliminary work, so much rehearsal, so much just in-depth discussion of the characters that I did not want to find somebody else. I just wanted to stick with her. So at that point we knew like, okay, we're going to have to do this on weekends.
Yeah.
And that's the way it started for the first block of shooting was like, it was kind of like one weekend a month or two weekends a month if we could make it work. And that was very slow moving. And then, not to get too much into it, but we eventually had to restart the film again because there was a delay because I was also working as a wedding filmmaker at the time. And that ended up taking up a lot of my time. So we had to put the film away again for a few months. And when we came back in 2022, we more or less had to start from the beginning because an actor dropped out. So then we started again weekends, just – and we were a little bit better about it by that point. It was about, I'd say, between May and July of that year, we were shooting. I think we had about 6 weekends that we shot.
Nice.
And we shot probably about 40% of the movie. But it was getting to a point where we were all realizing, look, if we keep going at this rate, this movie is going to take us another 2 years to finish. And at the time, Sydney was living in Chicago. Emil, who plays Xavier, was living in Burlington. Most of the shooting that we had to do was all in Dubuque. And so we just said, you know what, screw it. Everyone, let's work remotely. I'll, you know, work my day job. We're going to shoot at night. And that's what we affectionately call Hell Week because from Sunday to Saturday, I think it was the second week of November 2022, weekends we would shoot all day. But Monday through Friday, we'd all go to work. We'd get off work. And I'd immediately drive to set. I'd have all my gear in my car, drive to set, and start setting up. And we would shoot until probably like 11 or midnight.
Wow.
And go home and start the day over again.
So, yeah, some like true like weekend warrior stuff that then went into like full on, you know, working two jobs.
One as a
delivery driver and one as a filmmaker, right? Yep. Moonlighting,
I guess, is
what they call that, right? Yeah, so getting into production a little bit, what was the – I gather from that answer, there wasn't necessarily a typical day on set, but talk about those weekends, like how you kind of structured those weekends, like how many days, was it Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday only? And then like, what kind of workflow things did you find working for you once you actually got the camera rolling? Like how many takes were you doing? That kind of stuff. Like what was working for this film?
Yeah. So when we were doing the weekends, we would do Friday and Saturday. Typically on Thursday, if we were shooting at a location that we knew we needed to decorate, Thursday, me and Maddie would go and we would decorate the set.
Got it.
And then Friday, I would get off. I would try to leave work early and I would get to set. And this is something I try to do in general. I would want to be the first one on set. And I like to be there. if I can, a half hour to an hour before everybody else, just because like I want to be in the space. I want to kind of start, get the camera on my shoulder, start figuring out what the movement's going to look like, where we can put lights. And then once the actors had gotten set, and I'll get a little bit into this when we talk about the actors, but we had done so much preliminary rehearsal that a lot of the time, at least the leads, more or less knew they were off book, they were on their shit. And it was mostly a matter of where are you going to stand and where are you going to move. And by the time we would get to location, we would kind of have a pretty good idea of what that was. So a lot of the time it was pretty like they'd get there and we'd be set up in 20 minutes and we would just start rolling. And in terms of takes, I feel like I averaged probably around like 4 or 5 takes.
Yeah.
When we could manage it, there were sometimes it was, we didn't have that luxury, but I always tried to get, in terms of coverage, like it's funny how the more you shoot, the less coverage you feel like you need. I don't know. I've felt like, and you know, you want to make sure you get everything, but like, as we look at like the first scenes of the movie, and there was a lot, or the first scenes we shot, and there was a ton more coverage of things that were just not important.
Yeah.
And as we kept going, just letting the scene play out in these like big wides was like something that I just really started leaning into. And then just kind of, you know, punching him for their mid shot or their close up. I didn't try to do a ton of close ups. I tried to keep those reserved for very special moments. But yeah, it was, I tried to keep the setups till 3 or 4 for coverage just to keep things moving.
Yeah.
And just, you know, let the scene, whole scene play.
Yeah. I found that that's about the average for most indie sets, I think, is in that sweet spot's like 3 to 5.
Yeah.
And you only find yourself in that like sort of 6 to 9 when it's like a difficult blocking or a difficult sort of move or something. There's another level of difficulty added. I think some directors I've worked with in the past have said, if we don't have it by take 3, we don't have it. We won't get it. which I like that sometimes because it's like, I'm like you with Ellie and Xavier. Like I prefer to do all the work ahead of time. So then we come to set. It's like quicker.
I forget who said it, but I heard somebody describe filmmaking like, pre-production is like the martial artist preparing for a fight.
Yeah.
But then when you get into the ring, like all that prep kind of has to just, you're in a fight now and you just got to make it work.
Well, that's why there's so much prep, because it becomes almost muscle memory.
Yeah.
I as a hockey player think about, you know, coaches that would teach us specific game situations. Like if this happens, you have 3 options. Here are the 3 options. Here's the 2 good options. And you just learn those and you like, so when the puck comes to you in that certain circumstance, it's just almost like memory and you're just like, oh, I put the puck here. And it's boring for some people, right? Like,
yeah.
I think that way of thinking and preparing is boring for some people. But I love pre-production. It's my favorite part of filmmaking. It's really where I feel like I get to be the most creative. So it's cool to hear that you did a lot of rehearsals. And that's a great segue to a question about actors and like, you had your hands full with this film, so you're the writer, director, editor. You did lighting as well, I'm sure Maddie helped a little bit with gaffing, but like you had your hands full. So how did you? What tactics did you employ during pre-production to make sure they were headed in the right direction? And then how did that sort of change when you got to production? Were you just like hands off, no notes, it's yours, or was it like here's a couple notes? Like how did you direct on the day?
Couple notes on the day, but honestly, most of the performances were developed in rehearsals, and that is, again, pre-production. And it's, I love working with actors. I love working with actors so much. It's probably my favorite aspect of the process. And especially like Sydney, again, going back to why we stuck it out and we made the Chicago trips work. When she was cast, she hadn't really done a ton yet. She had done a couple of plays, but this was her first film. And she was a little overwhelmed by like, oh, I'm going to be the lead in a feature. Like, and so we did like full script breakdown, like line by line of the script. I went through that with her. And we just, there was just so much rehearsal for even the smaller characters, like the friend Derek, the you thirsty fucker guy. Like funny. Even him, like, you know, I'd be like, okay, like if we're going to do that, if you want to get, let's be this character, like let's get on the Zoom call and let's, you have 3 scenes, but like, let's go over those scenes in depth and let's have you read with Emil. And same thing with like, Kinsey, who plays Michelle, Ellie's roommate, three or four scenes, but she was there from the beginning. And it's like, no, let's get on a call. Let's deep dive this character and let's have you read with your co-stars, even if it's just over Zoom. But like being able to give those notes and give that, you know, figure out who this character is ahead of time.
Yeah.
Was super important because, yeah, on the day, a lot of times, like, yeah, I didn't give a ton of notes, especially like for Sydney and Emil, because they knew it so well.
Yeah.
We always, if there was ever an issue, we would rehearse it like one or two, well, I think three times was always the thing. Like, if they couldn't begin the lines, like, right, let's just go walk through the scene three times. Okay, we got it. And then very little notes after that.
Yeah.
It was, and that's, you know, a testament to the actors as well for knowing their stuff and being great.
Yeah. How much did you learn as a director in that pre-production process?
Like, oh, in pre-production.
Like having the rehearsal time. I mean, I feel like that's not, honestly, it's not really typical. Like,
no, it's not.
And
you
don't really get that. I think that there's directors that fight for it.
And I want to fight for it going forward, because like even just me, even as the writer and the director, seeing what the actors brought to the characters and being able to just focus on that and in a quiet sort of, I don't say intimate, but like, you know, a more personal way of really seeing them kind of develop the characters. It changed, and it didn't change the script a ton, but like, you know, it changed the look of it. Like Michelle, who's Ellie's roommate, didn't necessarily start off as like kind of a punk rocker kind of girl, but like Kinsey sort of brought that energy to it and brought like the amount of F-bombs she dropped and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And just seeing those things develop and being willing. And, you know, I'm not married to my scripts. Like I'm perfectly okay with, you know, actors changing dialogue if it's not working, as long as it fits the script or fits the story. And just seeing like that and seeing the way that the actors are giving a little bit of themselves to the characters was so invaluable. And I really think helped elevate a lot of the minor characters, especially.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a testament to you to remain sort of malleable and flexible. And I think that's another thing that, you know, we talk about a lot on this podcast is like, when you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of time, you got to be flexible because something might happen and you have to react on a dime to change your mind and make this decision.
Yep.
Even though you might have been married to something for months.
Years.
Years.
Sometimes.
Where you envisioned it, and then you get there and you're like, we can't do it that way.
Yeah.
And I personally love that about filmmaking. Yeah. So how did you overall approach problems? Like when they arose, how did you approach, like what kind of conflict manager are you? Or did you need a second? Did you have to step away?
Were a couple of times I needed a second. I'm definitely somebody like the moment something happens, I have to kind of like have my little like, and then breathe and calm down. But with this movie, honestly, like whatever, if there was a problem, there was almost just not enough time to really even deal with it. It was more like, well, we just have to keep going.
Yeah, it was such a DIY punk rock mentality for this film, I have to say. Like,
thank you.
That I love. And I think that is also in line with the story. Mm-hmm. You know, the more I think about it, the more authentic these sort of party scenes feel. And especially in the way that you tried to make them authentic and not Euphoria. Like, you know, not to bash Euphoria, but like, yeah, I mean, we can do that later together. Yeah. I will join it on that. But it's not like super heightened. It's kind of dull and like this is it. This is, you know, but the characters are saying that same thing. They're saying, this is it.
Yeah, this is all this. And that's, I mean, that was kind of the mentality of the movie as well, as just this, like, you know, again, kind of going back to my like qualm with a lot of college movies are just like party movies. And like, they're fun and I don't want to bash them, but like, my college experience, like I remember the first party I went to, I showed up, everyone was already drunk and I was sober. And I was like, oh,
this is weird.
This is just weird. Like, I just feel like I'm out of place. And these people are like, you know, just screaming and running around and playing these games. And I'm like, that was kind of the initial, and you know, then I'd get drunk and join them. But
yeah,
but there was that was always kind of the funny thing to me is like, you know, most college movies lead up to the party. And the party's like this big bash. And I was like, we're going to start at the party and the party's going to suck.
And things are way more awkward in real life than they are in the college movies. Like everybody's awkward.
Yes.
Like everyone.
Everyone in life is awkward.
And a lot of the things you're experiencing, like you're experiencing together for the first time, you know, and someone like hands you something and you're like,
what is this?
And then you do it and you're like, whoa. And then life takes a turn. College, what a crazy time. Mm-hmm. Speaking of like college, I think what about that sort of setting? Mm. You kind of talked about it a little bit, but like coming of age, right? College. Those two things go together so well. What is it about that period of time that appeals to you as a storyteller? Why tell a story in that window of someone's life?
Yeah, well, I love coming-of-age films. They're one of my favorite genres. And for me, I feel like college is such an interesting time because, yes, you are out on your own for the first time, but you're still not quite an adult yet. Everyone's kind of you are legally an adult. You can, like, go do adult things now, and you have the freedom to go do what you want. But, you know, you don't own property. You might have a car, but you can't, like, take out a loan on a house or an, I don't know, maybe you can, but if you have the money. But so there's this, like, weird thing where you're, like, still basically a child in your mind.
Yeah.
You might think you're not, but you are. And there's so much – and even though it's this kind of, like, almost cushion for – adult life is that, like, 18 to 22.
Yeah.
Being in college, it's like, okay, you have more responsibilities. You have more autonomy over your life. You now have the responsibility to make decisions for yourself, but you're not truly, like, out in the world and completely, like, in control of your life yet. Mm-hmm. And that time is coming up very fast. And if you don't, I was in, not to get too much into my personal life, but, like, my college experience was quite fraught with a lot of insecurity and a lot of, you know, like, I didn't finish college for a number of reasons, but the big one was, like, I don't feel like I'm going to be in a – I felt like where I was going with college and where I was going in school, I was like, I don't think I'm going to be happy in my life if I stay on the career trajectory that this is taking me in. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty difficult thing to deal with. When it's like, I've already got this money synced in and I've already got, you know, this plan, these plans of where I want to go, and realizing that that's not going to be, that doesn't seem achievable anymore.
Yeah.
And so those are all feelings that I feel like you kind of have to make when you're that age. And sorry if I'm speaking in circles, but
no, it's all like making complete sense. It's exactly what these two are struggling with in the film is this sense of pressure.
Yeah. And I feel like
be adults and what kind of adult are you going to be?
Exactly. And I feel like the stakes are much higher when you're in college and when Ellie in the movie is 19 and Xavier's 21. And even Xavier says, like, he's been in school for 3 years and he hasn't even picked a major yet. Like, he's in, like, the weight of that and, like, his lack of really sort of accountability of taking, you know, responsibility over his own life is catching up to him.
Yeah.
And that to me is because, like, yeah, like high school, or if you're, you know, telling a story about teenagers, which most coming of age films do, like, that is very formative years. Those are very, very fun years to tell stories about. And I probably will tell stories of my teenage years at some point. But I don't know. I feel like there isn't enough stories talking about just how difficult it is to really figure out who you are in college, especially, like, for a lot of people, it's the first, like, time they're going to get experience a lot of culture that they've never experienced before.
100%.
And yeah.
It affects you and it changes you a lot. And then you're like, who am I?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's how I felt. I remember just to get vulnerable and share something about my college experience. I remember being super depressed when I graduated because I had no fucking idea what I was going to do next. Mm-hmm. Partially because it was during, like, a real bad recession and I had applied for like 400 jobs and got like 3 interviews.
Yeah.
But it was just this end of this thing that was really fun and free. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like life just staring me in the face. Yeah. Like, what are you going to do next? So I think that it's really interesting that you – Not interesting. I think it's important that you told this story. I think a lot of people can sort of, you know, connect with these characters about, you know, with Xavier sort of feeling the pressure of the outside world and then Ellie sort of feeling the internal pressure of who am I? Why am I so different or weird or isolated, or why do I not feel like myself, or why can't I act like these other people? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that you can think of sort of a more human story to tell, you know, so bravo.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Talking about kind of transitioning from the college experience to your experience with finishing this, I think it's important to ask you like how your community supported you throughout the process of Ellie and Xavier, specifically, you know, during production and then post-production, finishing the film. How did people support you?
There was an incredible support system of people. You, for instance, let us borrow lights for one scene when shooting in Des Moines. There was a lot of, because we were such a small crew and because there wasn't really money, but so a lot of times if we needed extra crew, if it was like, we know we're going to need more than just me, Maddie, and a sound guy, we would put out a crew call like, hey, if anyone is interested in being a PA, or if we lost, if our sound guy wasn't available for a weekend or a couple of days, like finding somebody else to do that. We were never short on finding people and finding enough people during production. And I wish I could shout out everybody, but I would need a list of names in front of me.
Yeah.
All the people who donated their time to help us during production. Some of them literally would just come on and day play, didn't know us, and just were happy to help on a film. So the Iowa community was, the film community was really, really supportive and really excited. And even during production and post-production, when I was posting about it, people were like, oh, I'm very excited to see this because it seems like a, you know, they're just very supportive of the story. And they sounded, they were like genuinely, genuinely excited to see what it was going to become. And then in post-production too, a number of people, when I was on, you know, cut two or three and I was like, I need notes. I need to start showing this to people. And a number of people would reach out and be like, yeah, if you ever need me to watch it, like, give you notes. And there were quite a few people who watched the movie and gave very, very good notes to help us really kind of make sure we're on the right track for the edit. And then even in post, Kevin Thorne, who's a sound guy that I've worked with a number of times, he came on quite late in the process and did this final sound mix, which in my opinion, saved the movie because I am a sound mixer. I am not. And there was just a lot of times during the early cuts of the movie, I'm like, this movie, are we going to have to ADR the whole damn thing? Like this movie, it was brutal. And yeah, he came in last minute and did a whole pass on it and really, really fixed it up.
Yeah. I found that I've had similar experiences here but I think it's like that everywhere. Film, you'll hear it so many times on this podcast. I really do think that film is just community. Like, you can't make a film by yourself. I mean, you can. I'm not saying you can. You can make films by yourself. People have done it. They've acted in it. They've, you know. But really, what makes it valuable, what makes the experience what it is when you have your community sort of come and help you. So I was just struck by stories of, you know, grandmas putting actors up at their house and people making meals. And, you know, I think I maybe saw your mom in the credits or
my mom was our caterer. My mom made food for everybody. And, every time when people would get to say, they'd be like, did Lisa make food today? I was like, yeah. And they'd be like, Lisa, let's go.
Dude, I'm not joking. Like, I know that catering kit is great, but sometimes, like,
just a home cooked meal.
Oh, it's the best. And I've worked on so many films where it's like a family meal, you know, like the crew sits down at a table and eats pasta that somebody's mom made. And
it's,
you literally break bread together. And it's like one of my favorite parts of the process is like sharing that community. Because, like, you know, on set, it can be hectic. And honestly, there's been times where I'm like, what project did we work on? You were there? Okay, I'm sorry. That was really fun. But it's crazy how the time warp sort of happens in those slower moments of like having a family meal together is really important. So kind of getting to the tail end of our conversation here, I want to talk about the screening process for you. And like, can you talk about how it felt to be in that theater with everybody? And you know, I've always maintained that's like the ultimate goal, right? Is to sit in a theater and watch a film. Cause I'm always shocked at how much I learn when I first watch it with an audience. Like, it feels completely different. So what did you take away from your first screening with an audience, and how did it feel?
It made me realize my movie is the longest movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
And just for reference, the runtime is, what, 84
it's
minutes?
It's 82 minutes.
82 minutes, so not
but
a long
But it felt
film,
like yeah. I was watching The Irishman in that theater. But no, I mean, you know, it's always, the first screening is always going to be so nerve-wracking.
100%.
But it's also just so valuable. There's moments that people laughed that I didn't expect it. There's moments, the mirror shot, the mirror scene I've always liked that you referenced, but there's so many people who came up to me who said that, like, that scene literally brought them to tears. And I'm like, I always liked that scene, but I didn't realize it was that impactful to people. And having that and just sort of experiencing it. And there's a lot of points in the movie where, you know, there's not really jokes or anything. It's a lot of talking, the characters exchanging like personal stories or, you know, talking about what's going on with them. And I'm always nervous during those because there's no reason for anyone to like laugh or say anything. And so you're just kind of sitting in this quiet room with everybody. And I'm looking around and I'm like, are they engaged? Are they liking it? Are they enjoying it? And I think I felt, maybe it was just me trying to, you know, convince myself that everything is okay, but I felt there was an engagement with the audience. Mm-hmm. I saw people like, you know, whisper something to the person next to them, mm-hmm. or I didn't see any phones in the theater, which is a good sign, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's horrifying when you first do it. And I was a nervous wreck all morning yesterday. Yeah.
It's hard not to be.
But yeah, by the time it was over, it was just like, it was just this great relief, and the response was incredible. And yeah, I can't wait to show it. I want more eyeballs in front of it now. I'm like addicted to it.
I mean, that's what the final product is.
Yeah,
it's a movie isn't a movie until people see it.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
and yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Like, until yesterday, this movie existed on my computer, mm-hmm. and I've been watching it by myself or maybe with one or two other people, like as close to my face as you are right now. Mm-hmm. And just being able to see it in terms of also just seeing it big for the first time, like there yeah. was so much that mm-hmm. played better on a big screen.
Yes.
There were so many things that, like, seeing it tiny for so long and I'm like, is that going to read?
Yeah.
Are people going to see that expression, or is that expression? The funny thing, like, there's a couple of people who are intentionally a little bit over the top. And I was like, is this going to be too much? And then mm-hmm. you see it on a big screen. It's like, oh no, they don't seem over the top on the big screen.
Yeah. You learn so much by seeing it in the way that it's intended. Mm-hmm. And it's hard with shorts, right? Cause yeah. you don't always get the chance to see a short on a big screen, but a feature is like meant to be seen yeah. on the big screen. Like, mm-hmm. and I think, I don't know, you know, I can't help but watch films with a critical eye when I'm yeah. in there too. And the whole viewing felt really good.
Yeah.
So I think you should be proud.
I am very yeah. proud.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, because another thing that I want is I want people to pump themselves up sometimes, because yeah. you made a feature film.
I did it. I did it. Somehow,
and that's pretty impressive. So talk about the best path forward now for Ellie and Xavier. Like, I know you guys mentioned Festival Run. Mm-hmm. What gets you excited about that? And like, on a bigger level question, is that the way for a feature? Is that like what you...
I think for this one, yeah.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, long term, and I'll be the first one to admit, like, this movie has no commercial prospects. Like, there is, like, no one famous is in it. It's not a genre of a movie. I don't anticipate much in terms of distribution. I want to get the movie out there, and mm-hmm. we are going to start looking at ways to get the movie on services so people can watch it.
Yeah.
But honestly, you know, we made the movie for us, and we made the movie ourselves, and so it's doing a festival run is exciting because I get to show the movie to other filmmakers and other people. And mm-hmm. yeah, kind of the whole point of making the movie was not the whole point of making the movie, but one of the points of making the movie was to show that we could make a movie, mm-hmm. that we could tell a long form story. Mm-hmm. Cause that is anyone can make something, maybe not anybody, but a lot of people can make something that's, you know, hits that 80 minutes. But yeah. I really wanted to try to make something that was worthy of those 80 minutes.
Yeah. Are you planning on going to all the festivals?
Yes.
That's why I asked this question, is because there's so much value in that. that if you're going to do a festival run, like, and I'm not trying to be like the head honcho of film festivals, but try to go.
No, exactly. And like, I have zero interest in collecting laurels or awards. I only want to go to film festivals because I love film festivals. Mm-hmm. I love the energy at film festivals. I love talking to other filmmakers. I love meeting other filmmakers. Mm-hmm. I love watching movies with the filmmakers and talking about them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so for me and for this movie, I feel like that's where we're going to build our audience. And that's where we're going to build where more people are going to be. The kind of people who would want to watch a film like this are going to be.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's smart. I think that's why I wanted to talk about this is like when you make a no budget feature, like what's next, you know?
Yeah.
And I think what's next is you use it as almost a business card, a calling card
absolutely.
At festivals and who knows who you're going to meet, but you got to go to meet them, right? So
yeah,
I'm glad to hear that you're doing that. And kind of a high level ending question here. Now that the film's done, what's one of the most valuable lessons you learned? And then what subsequent advice would you have for someone who wanted to produce their own no-budget independent feature film?
I'm going to go back to what you talked about with Community, because when I started working on this movie, I thought it was going to be just me working on it. Like, yeah, probably somebody on sound. And, you know, we haven't really talked about the timeline as much, but just so everyone knows listening, this movie took 5 years of my life. And when I decided to make it, I didn't know this man sitting across the room from me right now. There's so many people that I met and that I learned from and also helped us out on the process that even though my name is in the credits, I think 5 times, I don't view it. I don't think I never view any movie that I make as wholly my movie. I'm not personally a fan of a film by Benjamin Schmidt. That's never going to be on any movie that I ever make, because I see all of the collaboration and I see all of the people that gave a part of themselves to it. And so I would say if you are a young filmmaker or you're a filmmaker who wants to go out and make your first feature, even your first short, and you think you're going to have to do it all on your own, one, you don't have to. If you can and you make it work, hell yeah, super proud of you. But know that there are people out there that want to help you and want to see you succeed simply because you have the gall and the tenacity to actually try to do it. And if you listen to those people and you let those people in and let them help you, not only are you going to become better, your movie is going to be much, much better.
That's why I love this podcast. I'm honestly tearing up a little bit because that is what it is. I mean, every time on this podcast, someone just encapsulates what I love so much about film. Yeah. Well said.
Thank you.
Amazing. I don't have much else, so we're going to do the sign off here. Uh-huh. That was Ben Schmidt. I'm Bruce James Bales, and that's a take.